Solve, secure, protect. Look to Patel for the independent thinking and cross-disciplinary focus it takes to advance security and safety in a changing world. They provide their clients with integrated solutions that secure our nation and help solve challenges within infrastructure, environment, emerging threats, and deployable mission-ready technology. Their teams leverage their deep expertise to develop science and technology for a healthier, safer, and more sustainable world. Visit Patel.org to learn how Patel makes the impossible possible. All right, on today's episode, I welcome back to the show Ms. Madison Arcangeli and Ms. Katie Nazartova from Forza DC. They were on our show a couple months ago, and we had an episode that talked about the defense budget process. But of course, since then, we've had a very busy time on Capitol Hill with the defense bills coming to the floor. And so since we are now entering the what is known as the August recess period, where everybody in DC goes home and on vacation, we thought it would be a good time to bring them back on to talk a little bit about what we learned from the bills and kind of what the way ahead is. So Madison, Katie, great to have you back on From the Crow's Nest. Thanks for taking some extra time to join me this morning.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Yeah, it's great to be back.
All right, so let's just get started with a quick overview kind of where we're at. So just basically start off, I wanted to kind of talk about like where we're at right now. It's August recess. Congress just left Capitol Hill to go back to the districts. Very busy July. So what was on Congress's plate in July in terms of defense?
I'll kick it off. So coming out of the Armed Services Committee, the committee had a really strong bipartisan vote. Only one member voted against it, which was Rep. Ro Khanna from California, which was not a surprise to anyone as a really strong progressive member in the House. On the floor, on July 14th, it passed 329-101, another really impressive bipartisan vote. During the floor consideration, the House considered hundreds of amendments. There were over 1,000 amendments that were submitted to Rules Committee. I would joke and call it the good idea fairy was there. She was very active this year.
And with the amendments, I mean, I remember, you know, back on the Hill, you know, we used to consider like, you know, 200 amendments just outlandish that someone would, we would try to offer 200 amendments. And this was where did these 1,000 amendments come from? I mean, it's quite remarkable to me, you know, that this process has exploded so much with kind of being the vehicle that these good ideas get attached to. It's kind of the proverbial Christmas tree where all the ornaments and everybody's favorite ornament is hung up on the tree. So while we're on that topic, explain how that worked out, because obviously the House did not consider 1,000 amendments. So how was that narrowed down to a manageable slice so that Congress could pass the bill in July on schedule as they had planned?
Yeah, so I'm happy to take that. So basically how that happens with any big bill that the House considers is that members have a specific deadline, usually a week, to offer all these amendments. And the NDAA usually wins on the number of amendments that people decide to put on that because people know that this is a bill that is going to pass and passes every year. And so this is kind of a lot of people's opportunities. So you see a lot of things that are germane to defense and other things that are not at all, but people think it's a great opportunity for them to pass it. So then at the end of that kind of week stretch of, you know, offering amendments, that all goes to the Committee on the Rules that has their own hearing on this bill and eventually decides which amendments are made in order. So which ones are going to be considered on the House floor and which ones are not. This year, it was about 600-something that ended up being made in order. So still a huge number, but about half of those that were offered. And then it is up to the powers that be, once again, being the Rules Committee, et cetera, to decide which amendments go in the big en bloc packages. So these are the packages that are non-controversial, that people are going to easily be fine with passing. And so they all kind of get together.
And these typically will be either passed by voice vote or sometimes they'll be passed as kind of a result of approving the rule for consideration of the bill, correct?
That's correct. And I think for the most part, they all did get a recorded vote this year. And I don't know what the reasoning behind that was, but maybe members just wanted to message on it or what. I think this year they did. And then there's always a handful of other amendments. And what the House Armed Services Committee does really well on this is that they publish an amendment tracker that is updated pretty often. So anyone can really follow that along on their website on the amendments that need to be debated. So these are kind of either big ticket items that are very controversial, like Rep. Barbara Lee's AUMF debate every year, or other various things debated, like related to nuclear deterrence or anything like that. And those either get voiced down, so voted down immediately, or the member asks for a recorded vote just to try their luck with the full House.
So what were some of the, you mentioned it is bipartisan, but there was one vote against it in the committee, progressive member. And I don't know what the breakdown of the opposition, the small opposition to the passage on the floor, but it might have been more diverse because there's a number of different perspectives on that defense budget. But what were some of the big ticket items that were either discussed or caused members some heartburn? Obviously, the top line spending was one, but there was some other big ticket things that just kind of attracted a lot of attention.
So at least in the committee, some of the big items that got, I will say, consumed a lot of the debate time were critical race theory issues, vaccine mandates, nuclear stockpile, nuclear weapons issues, like Katie mentioned. And also, Ken, like you said, the top line, there's definitely a fraction of the Democratic Party that is opposed to higher defense spending, certainly, but also thinks that the president's budget would have been too high as well. And so there's almost every year, a pretty reliable block of Democratic votes that will just not vote for the defense bill at all. And then this year, you see the 101 that didn't vote for it on the House floor. That is a mix of those Democrats and also some Republicans who make the argument this bill is full of Democratic social priorities and blah, blah, blah.
And then there were probably also some Republicans that, I don't know if this was, I did not look at the vote count, but usually either it's maybe a little bit too high, but mostly even maybe not high enough on the Republican side. And so you end up mixing these two diametrically opposed forces and they still end up opposing the same bill.
Yep, absolutely.
And so there was an amendment that was offered on MSO that I want to get to in a minute. But just, before we get there, just wanted to talk about some of the funding lines that attracted your attention and obviously the attention of some of your, of the defense community and the House NDAA. And then I want to talk a little bit about the amendment.
Yeah, so I can kind of talk about that a little bit too, because right now it's kind of interesting because technically we have four bills that we're looking at. The House and the Senate NDAAs are their two separate beasts, and that goes along with the Senate and House appropriations. So as you all remember, we sent a letter earlier in the year on to House and Senate leadership on these committees on, EW priorities that should be funded that were included in the services unfunded priorities list. So those were kind of the things that we were tracking as these bills came out throughout the last few months. And so kind of the biggest things that I can go over in the NDAAs, and then if we have time, we can kind of go through the appropriations bills as well. But all of them, safe to say, were different. There's a lot of priorities that were kind of funded across the board like they were in the president's budget. Some things like the Senate NDAA increased funding for ground air task-oriented radar, so GATOR radar. It included ARNG plus-ups as well. Everything else was pretty level in the Senate Armed Services Committee NDAA. And then the House NDAA included quite a few good things. They blocked the Navy's proposed retirement of the EA-18G Growlers. There was report language on sensor open systems architecture and CMOS standards evaluation and enforcement, and then some other things on Secretary of Defense briefing on EMBM and AI and multi-domain operations, and just a pretty good, robust bill for EW priorities.
It's interesting because this year it's the House bill that has all the good provisions in it that we want to talk about as a community. Some years it's the Senate, and sometimes we don't know until we actually see the bill. Like, this year everything got into the House bill, which is nice, and we got that first. I just was looking at the Senate bill, and I was like, all right, there's, I guess, some stuff there, but I haven't had a chance to dig into it. But it's clearly the House bill is the one that I think, you know, our community needs to focus a lot on, because there's a lot of goodness in that bill that we hope will make it through to the final processed and into the conference report. One of the things I wanted to bring up, though, is, you know, for those who follow AOC's work on the Hill, you know, we work a lot with this congressional EW working group led by four members of Congress, Congressman Rick Larson, Congressman Don Bacon, Congressman Jim Langevin, and Congressman Austin Scott. And Congressman Larson and Congressman Bacon joined forces to offer an amendment to that NDAA that was accepted and voted on, approved on the floor. So I want to kind of go over that a little bit. And just, you know, could you tell our listeners a little bit about that amendment and, you know, how that came to fruition?
Yeah, so I can go over that a little bit pretty quickly. So in leading up to, or actually a little bit after markup, we had several congressional engagements to kind of either check in with, especially members of the EW working group who are very much aware of, you know, the state of play, or to new members who may be interested in EW, and kind of educate them on what it is and why they should care. And so as part of the EW working group engagement, one of the things that we discussed in these meetings were the need for transparency on the MSO Superiority Strategy Implementation Plan. And so that kind of perked the interest of Rep. Larson's staff. And out of that, and through work with them, with Rep. Bacon and Rep. Langevin, we came to a sense of Congress, which essentially this amendment states that it is a sense of Congress that electromagnetic spectrum superiority underpins DOD's national defense strategy and directs the Secretary of Defense to provide Congress with an unclassified version of the implementation plan for the electromagnetic spectrum superiority strategy and all future updates to the plan. So this amendment was non-controversial, very bipartisan, made it into one of those big en bloc packages that we talked about before. And so very good news for EW.
Yeah, we'll put the language up on our AOC website for people to take a look at, because I think it's got a lot of goodness in it. One of the provisions that I really liked was is talking about providing a coherent response to persistent gaps. And I think this is one of the things that challenges our community to this day. You know, we have this great strategy. We apparently have a great implementation plan, although, you know, it's not always, a lot of us don't know what's in it, but we still don't have a coherent response. You go across the services, you go across agencies and DOD and offices, and you can get a lot of different stories about how we're implementing EMS superiority. And so there's not that coherent response. We still have persistent gaps in leadership, especially, you know, I mean, STRATCOM has really done a lot of good things. You have some good things happening in the services, but we still have gaps in leadership and everything. And so to see that recognized in the amendment, I think is good news. And hopefully, you know, it's not going to change things necessarily overnight, but making DOD know that Congress is watching this, you know, I think is great, and hopefully it will trigger a lot more conversations and engagements between Capitol Hill and DOD. But okay, but the amendment then is passed the House. What happens? We were having this conversation. It's kind of a leading question, because I had a question. I'm like, okay, how do we then figure out what needs to happen? The Senate bill came out shortly thereafter. It's not in the Senate bill, but the Senate hasn't considered the bill yet on their floor. So could you walk through the perspective of this amendment, like what happens next with these other bills coming to the floor?
Absolutely. So like you mentioned, the Senate bill was released. Normally when you see a bill released like that, at least with NDAA, something so massive, when the text gets released, the bill is filed, it's usually an indication you're going to see it move onto the floor within the next couple of weeks, maybe at max a month. And the reason they do that, they try to time it up that closely, is what I have called and others have called the hate machine could get turned on. People have time to read the bill, figure out what they don't like about it, throw a big stink about it, puts the bill in jeopardy of failing, I'm not passing. The good idea fairy comes back, basically. This time around, though, the Senate released their bill. You know, we have heard that it was because they wanted to be ready to go if the semiconductor chips bill didn't come to the Senate floor, but we don't know. It could also be because they don't think they're actually going to go to the floor. So we don't know exactly what the internal calculus was, but that's what the speculation is.
Is this a new trend Because this is what happened, I guess, last year, where it never actually came to the floor. I mean, I don't even know if it was actually released last year. I think at least this year we have a draft.
You know, it partly depends, I think, in the makeup of the Senate currently. Last year, it didn't come to the floor because they couldn't agree on what amendments to also bring to the floor. And so the Senate didn't vote. There was no way for them to get it off the floor once they took it there. So I'm not sure if it's a trend, per se, that could change after this election, depending on who is still in office and who is not. But, you know, as of right now, we are expecting the Senate bill to be considered in September. Of course, that, again, depends on have dynamics changed since last year or not. So if the Senate bill is brought to the floor, it'll get voted on there. And as it relates to this amendment, there's a couple of different ways it could go. If we can work with the Senate office to get someone on the Senate side to also introduce it, it's in both bills. That's great. Then it's not conferenceable. So it won't be negotiated in the conference. It's just in the bill. It will come through and be in the conference report. If it's not included as an amendment on the floor or the Senate does not consider their bill, that means we then have to protect the language during conference. When that basically means making sure that the language stays in, that when the conference report or some sort of final agreement comes out of both the House and the Senate, gets voted on, goes to the president's desk, our language is in it. And that's done, you know, by engaging the conference committee, engaging staff, bolstering up those really important supporters of ours with the caucus, a working group.
Hello, everyone. I want to take a short break to thank Battelle for their continued support for our From the Crow's Nest podcast. It's always great to hear from them, and I am pleased to be here with Rusty Cole Morgan, Navy veteran and division manager at Battelle. Rusty, thanks for joining me here on From the Crow's Nest. It's great to have you on the show.
Hey, thanks very much, and thanks for the opportunity.
You've had an interesting career with extensive stints in the Navy and industry. What brought you to Battelle, and how does your experience align with Battelle's mission?
Yeah, thanks for that, Ken. And I did have a very rewarding career as a Navy pilot. And as I transitioned through a number of companies in industry, I continued to have great experiences because I got the chance to work alongside eye-watering technical talent. What I'm most excited about at Battelle is how our campus is literally surrounded by an impressive depth of relevant applied researchers. That uniquely embedded in-house research capability serves as a foundation as we focus on solutions to the world's hardest problems. We strive to create a better world through science, and the RavenStar technology is the latest example of a hard problem with wide society benefits.
In the past, we've heard here on From the Crow's Nest from your colleagues, Doug Thornton and Molly Engel. They provided some intriguing insights about the RavenStar antenna. And can you tell our listeners a little bit about the challenges of this trade space and what you're trying to address with this game-changing technology?
Well, the bottom line is that users have had to sub-optimize their capabilities and needs with traditional design approaches in the RF spectrum. Traditionally, electronic warfare and command and control users on a number of capabilities that create a challenging design space. Those needs are typically long ranges, maximum throughput, and low probability of intercept, low probability of detection. They want those ranges for more effective operational reach or standoff, and they want more throughput for the increased data that leads to actionable intelligence. And those tight control of the emissions, they want those for either maximizing energy on a particular bearing or limiting the ability to detect or interfere with their emissions. It's not an easy trade space, but the flexibility of the RavenStar architecture gives them more of what they want operationally.
So what does the RavenStar do that makes it optimized across these critical performance needs, and how does that stand out from traditional approaches?
Well, our frequency agility gives operators flexibility to work an ultra-wide portion of the spectrum through a single low-swap software-defined aperture. RavenStar co-designed extremely wide-band aperture arrays with co-located advanced electronics. And this allows a compact, frequency-flexible RF solution. Our approach minimizes conventional antenna feature trade-off and allows significant design flexibility for delivering the spectrum dominance that's needed.
We've been tracking this program here on the show. How mature is RavenStar today?
We put it at a TRL 6 after testing that we've done in December of 2023, and continuing into this year, we'll do field tests, accompanying lab demonstrations, and development performance on formal efforts with different DoD customers, all that are pointed toward a continued maturation of the RavenStar design. They show the RavenStar's ability is to support all domain missions that require multiple communications.
Well, thank you, Rusty, for joining me here on the show. It's always great to hear from the Battelle team. And now it's time to get back to our show. Could you give some insight into how the conference committee just generally would work or might work? You know, it's always a kind of a secretive or not well discussed, you know, aspect of the legislative process here, you know. So we hear Congress goes in, brings up a conference report or goes into conference, and then magically this new bill comes out and all these agreements have been made. I would imagine that they're already kind of in that process, even though formally the bill may not have passed the Senate. Staff are talking, members are talking to try so that the conference process is smooth. Can we get a conference report done by the end of the fiscal year, or is it still looking that, no, we'll probably still be, you know, post-election or something in December?
Yeah. So to your first question about can we get something done before the end of the fiscal year, anything's possible. I would say that's very unlikely. And the most likely outcome is we have an agreement by December. This will be a Christmas bill. Everything sort of got pushed back this year. Everyone moved sort of late. To your question about the conference report and how conference functions, I heard a theory that the Senate released their bill in part so that staff can start doing exactly that, pre-conferencing. So they're lining the bills up side by side, doing comparisons and saying, this isn't both bills, this isn't the House bill, this isn't the Senate bill. And then starting to work through what are those things that they need to work through. There's varying layers, and I can talk more in depth on the staff side of things than the actual voting to go, you know, the formal conference committee and the role of members at the staff level. You know, it is broken down of the PSMs, the line PSMs, who are the experts in their, you know, in their each of their fields, are working both across from House to Senate and also across the aisles. So Democrat, Republican. Usually conference ends up breaking more down to a House versus Senate negotiation, defending each of their respective bills. And then what they cannot resolve then gets kicked up the chain, right? It'll go to the staff directors. Staff directors will do what's called the little four. They will all sit in a room or on a Teams chat now and try to hash out some of those more contentious issues. The stuff that gets kicked to them is a little bit more complicated. And then from there, whatever the little four cannot negotiate and figure out, we'll go to the big four, which is the chair and the ranking of the House and Senate Armed Services Committees. And then they will hash it out. And that final outcome is what's called the conference report, if it is in fact an official conference.
And what I will add just onto that from the staff perspective is that all of that essentially gets done between professional staff. The only time you really hear about any of your provisions is maybe if you check in, although you'll maybe get a yes or no on like things are going really bad or things are going really good and we need some help from you either way. But usually as a staff, like personal staff, you don't see anything until my boss was always a conferee. So we got to see it a little bit earlier than everybody else, but essentially you see it the day before it gets published. You go into the Armed Services Committee room and you get two giant binders, and you then have a limited amount of time, about an hour, to comb through thousands of pages to find your boss's provisions. So it's kind of like it is a black box until then, and then you're kind of checking in and hoping that people know you're still paying attention.
Just one last question. I wanted to, apart from hearing from people like me who constantly bug you about electronic warfare or something, you know, this far into the process, you could just kind of give your final thoughts on something that really kind of you wanted to highlight about the defense budget and what you saw, either be it a provision or a trend or a sense of where Congress is at on this topic that really kind of hit home to you during this process.
There are a few things. I mean, and this is probably more from a personal perspective and is probably of less interest to people listening, but I will say, knowing the players involved with getting the bill to the place where it is, I'm really impressed by how bipartisan it has been. There was an incredible amount of turnover on the House Armed Services Committee, with the staff director leaving and there's a new staff director, there's a new deputy, new head of policy. And I might be biased here, but I think they all did a really incredible job. And that's a really hard thing to do. And again, really speaks to the commitment to bipartisanship and decorum of the institution. That is a strongly held belief from the chairman and the ranking member. They both really prioritize that. And you really saw that in this outcome. The other thing that really stands out to me that might be more of an interest to listeners is not personal, is the way the numbers broke down. So the top line for House NDAA after the ranking member's amendment was accepted during markup is $849 billion. The Senate came in at $857 billion. And then you have the appropriation side of things, where the House Appropriations Committee came in at the president's budget request of $762 billion. And then the Senate Appropriations Committee came in at $850 billion. So that's a pretty big discrepancy between where HACD came in compared to everyone else. You know, I think we will see that number change. The number will most certainly be higher than the president's budget request, probably somewhere around that 840, 850, but it's up for a big debate still.
It was a very, at least took me a little bit by surprise, the level of increase. I mean, I know that there was a lot of talk, obviously, a lot of concern about keeping up with inflation. And of course, you have Russia and Ukraine and some other mitigating factors, but it's still not, I think, given the political climate and, you know, the election year, I was surprised that there was so much bipartisan support for such a large increase across most of the bills, you know, letting alone, obviously, the House Appropriations bill. So I thought that was a really good sign that there was a lot of shared perspective on our defense and the need to provide funding for it.
And I guess the one thing that I will reiterate that we all already kind of mentioned is that out of the four defense bills, I mean, clearly it's the one bill that kind of went through everything and then passed out of the House. So it's going to be bigger in general. But I do think policy-wise, especially as of now, the House Armed Services Committee did a really good job on the NDAA. And it's a very strong kind of leader for defense policy in Congress.
Yeah, and it definitely from the EMSO electronic warfare front, I mean, that's the strongest bill. And that's all due thanks to some tremendous members on that committee and in the EW working group. They do a great job of kind of making sure that Congress is engaged on this, because it's easy to get lost in a lot of these other issues that come up as we were talking about the thousand of amendments. And one of them, of course, was for us and for our community. And I think it'll help. And so it's good that the Armed Services Committee and those members in there were able to be as effective. I wanted to just thank you again for being on the show. Hopefully, you know, we'll have you back in a few months once we wrap up everything. But looking forward to having you back, and thank you for joining me on From the Crow's Nest.
Absolutely. We're looking forward to it.
Thanks so much.
That will conclude our episode of From the Crow's Nest. I'd like to thank our guests, Madison Arcangeli and Katie Nazaratova from Forza DC. Also, we always like to hear from our listeners. If you could take a moment to rate and subscribe to our show wherever you download, we look forward to hearing from you and ways that we can continue to improve the show. Thank you for listening. This podcast is brought to you by Battelle, the world's largest independent, not-for-profit, applied science and technology organization. Since 1929, their mission has been to translate scientific discovery and technology advances to benefit society. Through markets such as health, environment, infrastructure, industry, and national security, Battelle has been delivering cutting-edge solutions that impact the well-being of the world and help keep us safe at home. To learn more, go to battelle.org/connect. That's BATTELLE.org/connect.